Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. Today on the show, Jill Robbins brings us Ask a Teacher. Later, we'll hear an American story, the first part of The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane. But first, Ashley Thompson and I have this story. Muqaddas Ashraf was 16 years old when her parents forced her to marry a Chinese man who had come to Pakistan looking for a wife. Less than 5 months later, Muqaddas is back in her home country and pregnant. She is seeking a divorce from a husband she says was abusive. Muqaddas is one of hundreds of poor Christian girls trafficked to China. The market for wives has grown quickly in Pakistan since late last year, activists say. Sometimes Christian clergy members help the traffickers in exchange for money. The clergy will find very poor parents and promise them wealth in return for their daughters. Parents receive several thousand dollars. They are told that their new sons-in-law are wealthy Chinese Christians. But most of the men are neither wealthy nor Christian. That information comes from several brides, their parents, an activist, church leaders, and government officials, all of whom spoke to reporters with the Associated Press. Most girls do not agree to the marriages. Instead, they are forced into them. Once the girls arrive in China, they find themselves alone in rural areas. They may face abuse and be left without any way to communicate with family back home or the Chinese around them.
Ijaz Alam Augustine is the Human Rights and Minorities Minister in Pakistan's Punjab province. He told the AP, "This is human smuggling. Greed is really responsible for these marriages. I have met with some of these girls, and they are very poor." Augustine accused the Chinese government and its embassy in Pakistan of ignoring the situation. He says they issue visas and other travel documents without asking questions. The Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs denied the accusation. It said China has zero acceptance of illegal marriage agencies. Human Rights Watch called on China and Pakistan to take action to end trafficking. It warned in an April 26th statement of increasing evidence that Pakistani women and girls are at risk of sexual slavery in China. This week, Pakistan's Federal Investigation Agency took action. It arrested 8 Chinese nationals and 4 Pakistanis in raids in Punjab province in connection with trafficking, Pakistan's GOTV reported. The agency said the raids followed a secret operation. The Chinese embassy said last month that China is cooperating with Pakistan to act against illegal trafficking centers. Officials said both Chinese and Pakistani youths are victims of these illegal agents.
Salim Iqbal is a Pakistani Christian activist and a reporter with a small Christian station, Isaac TV. He He said he first began to see increased numbers of Pakistani Chinese marriages in October. Since then, an estimated 750 to 1,000 Pakistani girls have been married to Chinese men, he said. Pakistan's small Christian community, centered in Punjab province, is an easy target. There are about 2.5 million Christians in the country's majority Muslim population of 200 million. Christians are among Pakistan's poorest people. They also have little political or social support. Parents in Pakistan often choose husbands for their daughters. A girl's family must pay a dowry for her to marry. They also have to pay for the wedding celebration. Pakistani husbands and their families often mistreat new wives if their dowries are considered too small. But it is different for marriages to Chinese men. The girl's parents are given money, and the men pay all costs connected to getting married.
Some of the men seeking wives are from among tens of thousands of Chinese workers living in Pakistan. They work on projects connected to China's Belt and Road Initiative. This effort has strengthened ties between the two countries in recent years. Other men search directly for Pakistani wives from China. They present themselves as Christians, but church leaders involved in the deals do not ask for any proof of this. They pay on average $3,500 to $5,000, including payments to parents, church leaders, and a dealer, said Iqbal. Iqbal has taken legal action in court to stop such marriages. He has also given shelter to runaway wives, some as young as 13. Mokadis's mother, Nasreen, said she was promised about $5,000. She says she received nothing, however. I really believed I was giving her a chance at a better life, and also a better life for us, Nasreen said.
Christian clergy leaders receive money from dealers to find brides for Chinese men, said Augustine. The provincial minorities minister is Christian himself. Many of the clergy are from the new small churches that are growing quickly in number in Pakistan. Gujranwala, a city north of Lahore, has been a special target of dealers. More than 100 local Christian women and girls have recently been married to Chinese nationals, Iqbal said. Clergyman Monk Morris said he knows a group of pastors in his neighborhood who work with a private Chinese marriage dealer. Among them, he said, is a leader at his church who tells church members that God is happy because these Chinese boys become Christians. Morris said the leader adds, they are helping the poor Christian girls. Morris opposes such marriages, calling them an insult. We know these marriages are all for the sake of money, he said. Pakistani and Chinese dealers work together in the trade. One leading dealer in Gujranwala is a Pakistani known only as Robinson. He refused to talk to the AP, but his wife told the AP that they organized their business through a Chinese marriage bureau in Islamabad.
Mokadis said her husband claimed he was wealthy. However, When she arrived in China in early December, she found herself living in a small house, just one room and a bedroom. She said he rarely let her out of the house on her own. He forced her to undergo a series of medical tests. She later learned the tests were attempts to learn why she was not yet pregnant. On the day before Christmas, when she urged him to take her to church, he hit her and broke her phone, she said. "I don't have the words to tell you how difficult that last month there was," Mukades said. "He threatened me." Finally, the man agreed to send Mukades home after her family said they would go to the police.
Mukades and another young woman from the same neighborhood, Mahek Liakat, said Robinson was the dealer in their marriages. Mahek's report of her life in China was similar to Mukades. Her husband was possessive, she said, and would not let her leave the house. In China, her husband, Li Tao, denied abusing Mahek. He said he was a Christian and worked for a state-owned Chinese company. He said he met Mahek through a Pakistani matchmaker introduced by a Chinese friend. Mahek's family contacted their government for help to bring her back. Then the police showed up at Li's home, and he said they told him he was illegally holding a woman. Mahek returned home to Pakistan. Others, however, are unable to come back. Mahek's grandfather, Idris Masih, said he contacted the parents of several other Pakistani girls in China who wanted to return home. All the parents were poor, and he said dismissed his attempts to persuade them to work for their daughter's return. He said each told him, "She is married now. It is her life."
In today's Ask a Teacher, we answer a question about saying goodbye. Our reader, Hideki, works at a high school in Japan with many international co-workers. She writes, "After having a short conversation with them, there are many times I come up with nothing to say at the end of the conversation." Hideki notes that she will see her co-workers later in the day at times, as in the first two examples below. Here are the times when Hideki wants to say goodbye. 1. When leaving a coworker in the morning. 2. When leaving a coworker in the middle of the day. 3. When leaving a coworker as you exit the workplace for the day. Answer. Dear Hideki, I lived in Japan, so I understand why you have this question. In your language, there are specific expressions people always use for such times. In English, though, there are several different things we can say when leaving someone. You guessed at some of them in your email. You said, "Maybe I should have said, 'Have a good one,' 'Nice talking to you,' or 'Enjoy your time off.'" Let's look at situation one. You are leaving a coworker, but you will see him or her at lunchtime. In a school, someone may say to a teacher, "Have a good class," or See you after class. If you are not speaking to a teacher, you can say, see you at lunch. See you a little later. Or simply, later. In situation two, you had lunch with a coworker and are leaving for the afternoon. Now you can say, have a good afternoon. You can also say, have a good one. That is the same as telling someone to have a good day, afternoon, or evening. Let's look at situation three, where you are leaving for the evening or weekend. On Fridays, you can always say, have a good weekend. On any other workday, you can say, good night, or see you tomorrow. There is one more time when you may want to say something. When you leave a meeting, you can say to others, see you later. Your suggestion, nice talking to you, is more common when you don't talk to someone every day. If you called a friend, for example, whom you have not seen for months, this would be a good way to close the conversation. Enjoy your time off is something we often say to people who are taking days off from work for vacation. This would not be said every day. And finally, in any work situation, you can always just say bye. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Jill Robbins. See you later.
From VOA Learning English, this is American Stories. Our story is called The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. It was written by Stephen Crane. We will listen to the story in two parts. Today, we will hear the first part of the story.
The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. The great train was rushing forward, such steady dignity of motion that a glance from the window seemed to simply prove that the flatlands of Texas were pouring toward the east. A newly married pair had come on this train in San Antonio. The man's face was reddened from many days in the wind and sun. His roughened hands were continually moving over his new black clothes in a most nervous manner. From time to time, he looked down respectfully at his suit. He sat with a hand on each knee, like a man waiting in a shop for a haircut. The glances he gave to other passengers were few and quick. The bride was not pretty, nor was she very young. She wore a dress of blue with many buttons. She continually turned her head to regard some part or other of her dress. It made her feel strange. One could tell that she had cooked and that she expected to cook dutifully. The searching glances of some of the passengers as she had entered the car had brought the blood rushing to her face. Her uncomfortable expression was strange to see upon this plain face, which was usually calm and almost emotionless. They were evidently very happy.
"Ever been in a train like this before?"
he asked, smiling with delight.
"No," she answered. "I never was. It's fine, isn't it?"
"Great. After a while, we'll go forward to the dining car and get a big dinner. Finest meal in the world. Costs a dollar."
"Oh, it does?" cried the bride. "A dollar? Oh, that's too much for us, isn't it, Jack?"
"Not on this trip, at least," he answered bravely. "We're going to enjoy ourselves."
Later he explained to her about the trains.
"You see, it's 1,000 miles from one end of Texas to the other. The train runs straight across it and only stops 4 times. He had the pride of an owner.
He pointed out to her the beauty of the car they were riding in. And, in truth, her eyes opened wider as she observed the rich sea-green cloth covering the seats, the shining silver and glass, the wood that shone darkly like the surface of a pool of oil. To the minds of the pair, their surroundings repeated the glory of their wedding that morning in San Antonio. This was the spirit of their new life, and the man's face in particular shone with a joy that made him appear foolish to certain passengers. In the minds of some, there was supposed to be something hugely funny in the pair's situation. "We're due in Yellow Sky at 3:42, he said, looking tenderly into her eyes.
"Oh, are we?"
she said, as if she had not been aware of it, to show surprise that her husband's remark was part of her wifely duty. She took from her pocket a little silver watch. As she held it before her and stared at it with a look of attention, the new husband's face shone. "I bought it in San Antonio from a friend of mine," he told her proudly.
"It's 12:17,
she said, looking up at him with a happy expression which, nevertheless, showed a lack of experience in conversing with men. A passenger, observing her small nervousness, laughed to himself. At last they went to the dining car. The man serving their table happened to take pleasure in directing them through their meal. He viewed them with the manner of a fatherly guide, his face shining with kindness. But they did not understand his attentions. As they returned to their seats, they showed in their faces a sense of escape. It was evident that, as the distance from Yellow Sky grew shorter, the husband became more nervous. His red hands were even more noticeable. He was rather absent-minded and far away when the bride leaned forward and spoke to him. As a matter of truth, Jack Potter was beginning to find his deed weighing upon him like a great stone. He, the town policeman of Yellow Sky, was a man known, liked, and feared in his community. He, an important person, had gone to San Antonio to meet a girl he believed he loved, and there he had actually married her without discussing any part of the matter with Yellow Sky. He was now bringing his bride to a sure-to-be-surprised town. Of course, people in Yellow Sky married as it pleased them, but Potter's thoughts of his duty to his friends, or of their idea of his duty, made him feel he was sinful. He was guilty of a great and unusual crime. Face to face with this girl in San Antonio, he had leaped all over the social fences. At San Antonio, he was like a man hidden in the dark. A knife to cut any friendly duty was easy to take in his hand in that distant city. But the hour of Yellow Sky, the hour of daylight, was approaching. He knew very well that his wedding was an important thing to the town. It could only be equaled by the burning of the new hotel. His friends could not forgive him, he felt. And now the train was hurrying him toward a scene of surprise, merriment, and blame. He glanced out of the window again. Yellow Sky had a kind of band which played its horns and drums painfully to the delight of the people. He laughed without heart as he thought of it. If the citizens could dream of his arrival with his bride, they would march the band at the station and accompany them among cheers and laughter to his house. He decided that he would use all methods of speed and cleverness in making the journey from the station to his house. Once safely at home, he would announce the news. Then he would not go among the citizens until they had had time to master their emotions. The bride looked anxiously at him.
"What's worrying you, Jack?"
He laughed. "I'm not worrying, girl. I'm only thinking of Yellow Sky." She understood, and her face turned red again. They shared a sense of slight guilt that developed a finer tenderness. They looked at each other with eyes softly glowing. But Potter often laughed the same nervous laugh. The deep red color upon the bride's face did not lessen.
"We're nearly there," he said. As the train began to slow, they moved forward in the car. The long line of cars moved into the station of Yellow Sky.
"The train has to get water here," said Potter from a tight throat and face, as one announcing death. Before the train stopped, his eye had searched the station, and he was glad and surprised to see there was no one there except the station master.
"Come on, girl," said Potter with a thick voice.
As he helped her down, they each laughed in a strained manner. He took her bag and told his wife to hold his arm. As they hurried away, he saw that the station master had turned and was running toward them, waving his arms. Potter laughed, and sighed as he laughed when he realized the first effect of his wedding upon Yellow Sky. He grasped his wife's arm firmly to his side, and they hurried away. The California train was due at Yellow Sky in 21 minutes. There were 6 men in the Weary Gentleman's saloon. One was a salesman who talked a great deal and rapidly. 3 were Texans who did not care to talk at that time, and 2 were Mexican sheep farmers who did not usually talk in the saloon. The saloon keeper's dog lay in front of the door. His head was resting on his feet, and he glanced sleepily here and there with the ready watchfulness of a dog that is sometimes kicked. Across the sandy street were some bright green grass spots, so wonderful in appearance next to the burning sands in the hot sun. At the cooler side of the railroad station, a man without a coat sat in a chair leaned back against the building. He smoked his pipe. The waters of the Rio Grande River circled near the town, and beyond it could be seen great flatlands. Except for the busy salesman and his companions in the saloon, Yellow Sky was sleeping. The salesman leaned easily upon a table and told many tales with the confidence of a storyteller who has found new listeners. He was interrupted by a young man who suddenly appeared in the open door. He cried, "Scratchy Wilson's drunk, and he has started to make trouble." The 2 Mexicans at once put down the glasses and disappeared through the rear door of the saloon. The salesman, not understanding the importance of the warning, jokingly answered, "All right, old man, suppose he has. Come in and have a drink anyhow." But the information had made such an apparent impression upon everyone in the room that the salesman was forced to see its importance. All had become instantly serious. "Well," he said, filled with mystery, "what is this?" His 3 companions started to tell him, but the young man at the door stopped them. "It means, my friend," he answered as he came into the saloon, "that for the next 2 hours this town won't be very healthy." The saloon keeper went to the door and locked it. Reaching out of the window, he pulled in heavy wooden boards which covered the windows and locked there. The salesman was looking from one to another. "What is this, anyhow?" he cried. "You don't mean it's going to be a gunfight?"
Come back to American Stories next week for the second half of The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane.
That's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with more stories from around the world. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.